Knap så dramatisk er det herhjemme, hvor det mest bliver skyet og med stedvis regn i de sydvestlige dele af landet, hvor der efterhånden kommer tørt vejr med sol og temperatur mellem 4 og 7 grader.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Danmarks nyheds- og debatradio. Hør os live eller on demand på radio247.dk. Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjær Ulf.
Velkommen til et program, der iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der er lukket og slukket og slået kors foran en mund, der til gengæld er åbne med syv sejl. Aflyttet befinder sig hos forbundet af IT-professionelt Prosa til et fyraftensmøde, hvor der holdes kryptoparty. Et kryptoparty, det er en uformel samling, hvor man mødes og deler sin viden om, hvordan man passer på sig selv og sin computer via kryptering. Noget, der er blevet mere populært oven på afsløringerne af NSA's overvågning. Her i aften der har der også været snak om whistleblower, og der har været snak om bitcoins, og nu kommer der snart en session om noget, der hedder Hushmail. Dagens aflyttet er også ret uformel. Vi sender en række af de indslag, vi af en eller anden grund ikke har haft plads til i programmet. Det er ikke fordi, de var dårlige, men fordi der af en eller anden grund ikke var plads i programmet lige præcis den dag. Det første af dem, det handler faktisk også om sikkerhed. Vi har nemlig talt med Jimmy Wales. Det er manden bag Wikipedia, det store opslagsværk, hvor brugerne selv skriver og redigerer opslagene. Den slags, det burde give kaos, men det gør det faktisk ikke. Hvordan kan det lade sig gøre at have Wales planer om at sælge ud til Google, spurgte reporter Esben Skovbo ham blandt andet om. Wales var nemlig gæst på An Open World-konferencen for at fortælle om sine visioner for Wikipedia, men også for at deltage i en større diskussion om åbenhed og demokrati på internettet. Og ja, privatliv. Esben Skovbo har talt med Jimmy Wales om, hvordan vi holder fast i privatlivet og vores frihed i en tid med massiv indsamling af vores personlige data.
Jimmy Wales er stifter af Wikipedia, og så går han meget op i åbenhed, demokrati og privatliv. For hvordan står det til med privatlivet på det, vi ellers ønsker at kalde et åbent og demokratisk internet, når nu vores personlige data flyder rundt derude, bliver indsamlet og analyseret af både store private firmaer og magtfulde efterretningstjenester over hele verden? Vi begynder med at tale om de private firmaer, der jo tjener sig styrtende med penge på at samle data om brugerne.
Well, I think we should all be a little bit concerned about the amount of data that's being collected on us. I'm not completely alarmed by it, but I do think it's something that people should pay attention to and should think about tools to protect their own privacy as much as possible. I'm not as worried about Google and Facebook as I am about the myriad of other players out there who are much less well known and actually less vulnerable to public pressure and to brand image. You know, Google and Facebook have a certain responsibility imposed on them by their users to take good care of data. I mean, we've seen in response to some of the NSA leaks that have come out from Snowden, Google has really scrambled to secure the last remaining links between their data centers and things like that. Why do they do that? They do that because they know that their customers care about it. But if you surf the web and if you install some software to keep an eye on it, you would be astonished at the number of tracking beacons and things that are out there from various advertising networks and people like this, most of whom you've never heard of, and who do provide, of course, a valid service. I think all of us like it if we get more relevant advertising than not. But when you've got, you know, dozens of people gathering up massive amounts of information who are not vulnerable to pressure, public pressure, because they're not public brands, that's something I think we should keep an eye on. And I'm a big supporter of Mozilla, although I think they've backed down recently. It's a complicated issue, but you know, they're looking to make it easy to block third-party cookies, and I think that's a good idea. It's one that some elements of the advertising industry are quite upset about, but I think people should have an easy tool to make those choices for themselves.
Jimmy Wales er bekymret, ja, men det gælder egentlig ikke så meget vores gode venner hos Facebook og Google. Han tænker mere på alle de firmaer, som vi ikke kender navnene på. Der er nemlig en hel underskov af reklamefirmaer, som samler data ind i stridestrømmen, og vi aner egentlig ikke, hvem de er. De har ikke noget offentligt brand at beskytte, som Facebook og Google har, og derfor har de frie hænder til at gøre, ja, næsten hvad som helst, siger Jimmy Wales. Jeg spørger ham, hvad han siger til lovgivningens rolle i det her billede. Mere specifikt spørger jeg ind til den efterhånden ret kendte lovpakke i EU, der går under kaldenavnet retten til at blive glemt, og den indbyggede spænding, der er mellem hensynet til privatliv og ytringsfriheden.
How do you see this tension playing out in the future?
Well, it's complicated. It's a really complicated issue, and I actually think that people who are putting forward a concept of a right to be forgotten are not actually doing the movement for privacy very much good. You in fact, as a matter of natural right, you don't have a right to be forgotten. To be remembered is in someone else's head or someone else's computer database, and it's a bit strange to assert a right to, you meet someone on the street and you say, "Oh, I didn't like that person. I want them to forget me." Well, that's not up to you. And so I think that expression is damaging because it just adds a lot of confusion. And what we should be looking at are questions about transparency around privacy practices, ensuring that there are serious penalties for companies who violate the agreements that they have with their users as to what it will be done with their data, a real sense of fiduciary responsibility around the data that you hold on other people. Those are the kinds of things that are meaningful and steps forward that would have a real impact, but also don't involve a philosophical confusion, such as right to be forgotten. One of the things that that is good. I mean, it's an interesting problem, and one of the reasons it's interesting is I'll use Amazon as an example, just because they're very good at it, and as a user of Amazon, a customer of Amazon, I think the fact that they take my data, the data that they know from what I've shopped in the past and what I've looked at in the past, to make recommendations to me, makes the service very useful. And there's nothing wrong with that. And any kind of ideas around user privacy and data that don't acknowledge that consumers are giving the data to Facebook for a reason. They're getting value back in return, and that's important. We may have some concerns about what it all means, but we don't want to disrupt that kind of thing. While at the same time, I think that people really have no idea the extent to which they're being tracked all over the web and so forth.
Retten til at blive glemt er et misforstået slagord, siger Jimmy Wales. Vi kan ikke selv styre, om vi bliver husket eller glemt, sådan er det bare fra naturens side. Han vil egentlig hellere fokusere på gennemsigtighed, på at give brugeren bedre indsigt i, hvad der foregår. Men snakken bevæger sig nu videre til et område, hvor der jo er en total og komplet mangel på gennemsigtighed, nemlig overvågning og NSA. De kan opsnappe vores digitale fodspor, lige når de vil og hvor de vil. Men hvilken betydning får det her så for vores demokrati?
So how do you feel about the web as a venue for intelligence gathering? Because we leave our digital footprints everywhere all the time, right? For someone like the NSA, and what does this mean for democracy?
Well, I'm very concerned about it. And one of the things that's worth pointing out is that while the United States is not a police state, I can speak out against the NSA as much as I want, and that's okay. But we've actually built all the machinery to create a police state, to create really quite a horrifying surveillance state. I mean, the East German Stasi, it would be their fantasy to have this much access to data, to have these collection points and to have this kind of massive collection of information on everybody. And I just think it's very unwise to build the machinery that could be so easily abused. We trust the current government, maybe. But do we trust the next one and the next one and the next one? And what happens, you know, we begin to see, questions about if they're willing to spy on Angela Merkel, if they're willing to hack into tens of thousands of corporate networks. Some of the revelations have been truly astonishing. At what point? And we know in history, I mean, if you just go back and think about the Watergate break-ins, and different presidents have been very tempted to do things very wrong. What happens when we have a president who's tempted to use this kind of data against political opponents? It can be incredibly effective to just drop a few leaks here and there about some private emails that somebody sent 25 years ago in terms of destroying people's political careers for political reasons. It's alarming, and it's something that I think we are finally beginning to see. Congress is a bit upset about this because they were lied to about what's going on. The general public seems to be quite upset about it, although not as much as I would like them to be. So I'm reasonably optimistic, but I do think we should be very concerned about this. And in terms of defense, I think we should begin to insist as consumers on as much encryption in as many places as we possibly can. Obviously, there are some concerns about how strong is encryption and so forth, but I trust the math. I trust people like Bruce Schneier, who says the math is good. Implementation is always difficult to do it well. At Wikipedia, we're taking steps to make sure that every connection to Wikipedia is encrypted, so that what you read in Wikipedia is between you and our servers, and in between, nobody can tell what you're reading, at least to some extent. And I think we should insist on that. There's a nice extension from the EFF, I think, produces it, called HTTPS Everywhere. And what it does is it very cleverly tries to, for every website you access, it tries to get you the secure version. I actually was curious about, and I couldn't find anything to do it, probably because it's too hopeless right now. I thought, what if I had an extension where my browser absolutely refused to make any HTTP connections, any insecure connections, and only make secure connections? I think the truth is it wouldn't work, because 99% of the web you wouldn't be able to access. But I think we should move to a world where basically your expectation is for 99% of the websites that I visit, it's as secure as when I'm visiting my bank. I think that would be an amazing and wonderful thing. And it's cheap enough now and easy enough for websites to begin to offer this. And I think they all should.
Stasi vil ikke turde drømme om, hvor mange informationer NSA indsamler, siger Jimmy Wales. Og selvom USA måske ikke kan kaldes en politistat, så har man jo rent faktisk opbygget hele det maskineri, der kendetegner en politistat. Og selvom vi stoler på den regering, der sidder i dag, hvad så med den næste? Og den næste? Løsningen, eller i hvert fald en del af løsningen, er kryptering, siger Jimmy Wales. Han stoler på matematikken, siger han. Og hos Wikipedia arbejder man for eksempel på at kryptere trafikken og skifte fra den almindelige protokol HTTP til det mere sikre HTTPS. Men det er ikke kun et spørgsmål om Wikipedia. Kryptering er faktisk et spørgsmål om helt grundlæggende menneskerettigheder, mener Jimmy Wales.
We continue talking about encryption. You once said that encryption is actually a human rights issue. Could you elaborate that point?
Yeah, encryption is a freedom of speech issue. It's a human rights issue. To make this clear, we should first put it in the context where it's very obvious. If you are a democracy activist in China, and you aren't advocating violence, but you're advocating increased democracy, increased openness, increased freedom, if you're advocating a change of government, you say we need new politicians, we need new political parties. You can see why you should be able to contact people and speak to friends and colleagues and associates in privacy. It's critically important as a human rights issue. And the same is true everywhere in the world. I think it's quite clear that encryption, you know, Edward Snowden has said strong encryption is the one thing that really works. It really puts a stop to this kind of thing. So, yes, we should consider it as a human rights issue. And any attempts to, as the NSA apparently did, to go out and undermine encryption standards by placing people on the bodies that decide them, who argue then against the strongest forms of encryption. I think we should view that as being, you know, it's very abstract for the general public to say, oh, well, what do I think about that? Actually, it's like really, really, really important. We'd be very upset if we found out that the NSA was, or the CIA or the FBI were, I mean, we do get upset. It has happened in the past where they infiltrated some activist groups and induced them to do wrong things. We should be just as upset if they're infiltrating scientific bodies, inducing them to do wrong things around encryption.
Kæmper du for demokrati i Kina, skal du kunne tale åben frit fra leveren, uden at frygte at blive overvåget, siger Jimmy Wales. Problemet kan være, at den her diskussion om menneskerettigheder hurtigt bliver abstrakt og svær at forholde sig til for den almindelige bruger. Og så til et spørgsmål, der har med os at gøre, alle os, der bruger Wikipedia. Kan Jimmy Wales love os, vi ikke bliver overvåget, når vi nu går ind og læser den næste artikel? Han vil ikke give et absolut løfte, men han vil gerne love, at Wikipedia-teamet gør alt, hvad de kan for at gøre livet surt for overvågerne.
I think an absolute promise is very, very difficult. But, you know, people say, well, look, certain forms of SSL, you know, with a supercomputer, the modern supercomputers, you know, they can crack it within, I don't know, 7 days. And I said, well, good, let's make them work. Let's make them take the 7 days to crack it, which means they can't just casually snoop on everything everybody's reading at Wikipedia. They're going to have to do the hard work. There's a lot of other things when we really look at it from a technical level, to really think about how to be secure. And it's an ironic thing because in many cases, many governments are actually, they have a split personality about this. Parts of the U.S. government are encouraging stronger security online. They realize the threat of, cyber criminals stealing credit cards and so forth. And they're very happy to say banks should use the strongest possible encryption to prevent, and, you know, credit card merchants and all that. At the same time, they're trying to undermine encryption. So it's a funny thing. So we'll do our best. We'll do our best because I think it is, particularly with respect to human, with respect to Wikipedia, it's a human rights issue. What you want to learn, what you want to read in the privacy of your own home is your own business. It could be very personal to you. It could be about your healthcare issues. It could be about your political views. It could be about your religion. This is critical, and everybody understands if we see a young person in Iran where homosexuality is illegal and persecuted, and they want to learn about homosexuality because they're having some questions about their own sexuality, everybody understands that's a human rights issue. It's just as much a human rights issue if that kid is sitting in Denmark or in the U.S. or anywhere. Everybody has a right to privacy.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
Det var altså Jimmy Wales, der fortalte, at man hos Wikipedia er i gang med at prøve at gøre livet surt for NSA og andre, der vil overvåge, hvad folk læser om. Aflytter jeg stadigvæk med til et kryptoparty hos Prosa, forbundet af IT-professionelle. Det, man sådan kan høre i baggrunden, det er folk, der holder pause og går lidt rundt. Vi skal nok komme lidt mere tilbage til, hvad det her kryptoparty går ud på lidt senere. Men nu skal vi videre til mere fra konferencen An Open World. Der bliver nemlig sat fokus på åbenhed på internettet. Og en af de varmeste fortalere for at åbne op og gøre data så tilgængelige som muligt for alle, det er Sir Nigel Chadbolt. Han hedder Sir Nigel Chadbolt, der også holdt et oplæg på den her konference. Esben Skovbo, han har talt med ham om åbenhed på den ene side og hensynet til privatliv og sikkerhed på den anden.
Sir Nigel Chadbolt er professor i kunstig intelligens ved University of Southampton, og så har han sammen med Tim Berners-Lee, opfinderen af World Wide Web, stiftet The Open Data Institute, et institut i England, som skal fremme udnyttelsen af åbne offentlige data til f.eks. at forbedre infrastruktur og effektivisere sundhedsvæsenet. En af Sir Nigel Shadbolts store ønsker er at udbrede en større forståelse af data i samfundet. Han mener, det må være en grundlæggende færdighed at forstå, hvordan data fungerer, og derfor er det også noget, skolerne bør undervise i.
One question for all of us is how literate are we about data? In the same way that we think it's essential to have basic skills in reading and mathematics, arithmetic, the basics of an education, will they require us to think about data, the analysis of data, understanding what the information in our information-dependent world means? I think it will. So we've been pushing hard for educational programs that allow us to work with people in school and colleges and in existing work environments to understand, the importance of data. How it's collected, is it collected fairly? What's the quality of the data? What can you do with it once you've collected it? This new data-driven world we're living in requires new skills everywhere.
Hvordan bliver data egentlig indsamlet? Det er et spørgsmål, alle bør undersøge nærmere i en verden drevet af data, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Og nogen, der indsamler data, rigtig, rigtig mange data, det er jo Google. Da Sir Nigel Shadbolt holder sin tale her til konferencen, nævner han Google og siger, spørgsmålet er, om søgiganten simpelthen ved for meget om os.
So you talk about the massive amounts of data and the potential for new and exciting insights, but during your talk today, you said that a company like Google, it seems like sometimes they almost have too much insight on who we are. Could you elaborate that point?
Well, obviously, we are living in an incredibly data-intensive world. We generate huge amounts of data ourselves, each and every one of us, and so do the actual activities we engage in and the transactions we make with other companies. A very successful company like Google, who is in possession of huge amounts of information, can not only understand the shape and structure of what we're doing, but also make predictions about what we might likely to do. It's not just Google. There are, the big online retail outlets like Amazon, the big social network sites like Facebook. And there is a genuine concern, I think, amongst users now that have they got too much information? Or if they have all this information, can I get the information back easily to myself? So if I give all the information to Facebook, how easy is it for me to move that data to another social network provider should I wish to? We've got exactly this problem when we think about how easy is it to move your bank account to another bank. It needs to be easy and straightforward. That's one fundamental thing. But then are there really alternatives? When you become so successful, do you then start to act as if you were almost a monopoly in control of so much information that your decisions can become very powerful? And I think Google themselves would admit that it's important that they are held to account, that actually we understand how the information is being used, that we understand the terms and conditions under which it's used. So hugely important that we are constantly in a conversation with each other as a society, between nations, between companies and individuals, between the companies themselves, to say, are the limits of this data use appropriate to our individual freedoms and liberties?
Google er så store, at de kan tillade sig at opføre sig, som var det et monopol, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Derfor mener han også, det bør være langt nemmere for brugerne at gennemskue dataindsamlingen og måske få noget magt tilbage over deres data og muligheden for simpelthen at tage dem tilbage. Google kan altså godt blive for store, men det kan databaserne med åbne offentlige data ikke, hvis man spørger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Det bliver nemlig ifølge ham essentielt at opbygge det, han kalder en datainfrastruktur. Noget den danske stat jo også er i fuld gang med digitaliseringen af det offentlige. Men når den infrastruktur bliver opbygget, hvordan sikrer man den så? Hvordan holder man styr på, at alle de her data ikke bliver misbrugt?
So how can we actually make sure that data isn't misused?
Well, there's a number of ways of replying to that. I think fundamentally, we will see a new kind of infrastructure that's just as important as our power grids and our water and gas distribution networks and our roads indeed. And it will be an information infrastructure. It will tell us about where the schools are, what the hospitals are, when the trains run, what the particular areas of the country are in terms of administrative geographies, how the police are doing, where the police stations are. All of this together becomes an integrated whole. How the courts are working, who's representing us in parliament, what laws are being passed at the moment. And as we build this, it's hugely important that people have equivalent access to it. So just like the web is based on this premise of universality, that anybody can get access through a web address to the same information, unless it's explicitly behind a firewall. You know, somebody has decided that this data cannot be accessed because it has to do with national security or it has to do with a person's private information. Of course, governments will need to make a decision about what is outside of full public scrutiny. But for many parts of the national infrastructure, this is just a public-facing, open information structure. And I think it's quite important that when we talk about the national information infrastructure, the open part should be as open as possible. And that will be a debate. You know, we in the UK had debates about whether we should release all the positions of where the national transport access points were. Well, that translates to where the bus stops are. Well, of course you're going to want to know where the bus stops are. Well, you know, are they a legitimate terrorist target? Yeah, but simply not publishing where they are isn't going to solve that problem for you. So I think we have to keep a balance between the interests of being open and the legitimate interest the state has in keeping us safe. And that piece, what they choose to keep secret and outside of public view, is a debate you constantly have to have. You cannot have states having these decisions without being made accountable.
Åbenhed, åbenhed, åbenhed. Princippet kan faktisk løse mange af problemerne, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Regeringer skal spille med helt åbne kort over for offentligheden. Hvilke data bliver indsamlet? Hvor bliver de sendt hen? Hvor kan man som borger selv finde de her data? Og så videre. Det er samtidig regeringens ansvar at beskytte data, der er private eller kan udgøre en fare for sikkerheden. Og sidst men ikke mindst skal regeringen selvfølgelig holdes ansvarlig for enhver beslutning, der bliver truffet på området. Men hvad når staten udliciterer vigtige opgaver med datahåndtering til udenlandske firmaer, som for eksempel den danske stat jo har gjort til amerikanske CSC?
I think when you outsource your data and your data infrastructure, if you do that, then I think particularly governments should be very careful about the actual conditions under which that license is granted or that service is subcontracted. And in the UK, we're changing our procurement rules now so that if you get a large supplier to provide a service and it has to do with public data, then the data cannot go with the service. The data remains public and open, and it must also remain in an open format using an open standard. Too often, companies lock governments into unfavorable procurements because they have a proprietary data format or proprietary system, which is theirs and theirs alone. And real problems can arise from this. It's not just about control. It's about what if the company no longer supports this proprietary format, the expense of then having to reacquire another one. And so I think that procurement is the key here, that governments have to think very carefully about how they procure services that have to do with computing infrastructure, information infrastructure, that are essentially sustainable into the future.
Vær forsigtig med udlicitering, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Man ved aldrig, hvilke aftaler man kan blive fastholdt i, når man afgiver kontrollen til private firmaer. Men på den anden side mener han også, det er en dårlig idé at lukke helt af for ens nationale datanetværk for f.eks. at prøve at være i fred for NSA's overvågning. Det er såvel fint nok at holde datatrafikken inden for landets grænser, men begynder man at gå væk fra åbne standarder, ødelægger man også meget af det gode, som internettet kan. Vi taler selvfølgelig om frygten for en såkaldt balkanisering af internettet.
Threat of balkanization of the internet. How do you see this playing out in terms of trying to keep the internet an open place?
I think that the general concern around intelligence services and others who wish to use large-scale information that's on the web, use it to understand what's going on, any intelligence agency naturally would see that as their business. The question is, what are the rights and limits on that on that process, and what is seen to be reasonable or unreasonable? And those conversations have to be ones that in democratic countries, there's an active conversation all the time between the agencies who wish to keep us secure and the people in whose name they are operating. And it's fundamental that the concern should be that our own civil rights and liberties aren't undermined by those very organisations who are trying to keep us free and at liberty. The general question, though, around balkanization, the web works by being an open infrastructure. Fundamentally, it's built on open standards, on assumptions that you can get to a page on the web from anywhere else using its standards, unless it is taken off the web by some explicit act of commercial protection or licensing. People are free to do that, but the power of the web has always been in large-scale connectivity and the unintended reuse that people make of other people's content, which all very often adds value. That's a massively powerful creator of value and innovation. And the danger that we have as we fragment the web in these various ways is that you lose that large-scale network effect. I think it's quite possible for countries to take views that in certain areas they will elect to have some of their processing stay within jurisdictional boundaries. And that will be a matter of deciding that national cloud providers are the preferred provider for this service or that service. That doesn't break the web. What does break the web is if suddenly the fundamental standards and protocols, the idea of universality, the idea of net neutrality, that you can get the same service essentially as someone else you're dealing with without the state or other organizations interfering with the provision of that service. If these things are kept in play, we keep an open web, we keep one web. If we break the web up into its components, we will lose hugely the beneficial effects of the web.
Vores privatliv er under pres. Det står tydeligt for enhver i dag. For Sir Nigel Shadbolt har det været tydeligt længe. I 2008 skrev han bogen Spy in the Coffee Machine, hvor han advarede om, at vores privatliv i den digitale verden var i fare. Her var helt nye udfordringer, som krævede nye former for handling. Og når man tænker på det i dag, er 5 år siden bogen udkom. Hvad siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt så i dag?
Looking back to 2008 and then looking at what has happened this year, have your worst fears been confirmed in this year of the Snowden revelations?
Well, it's scary to say we told you so, but we told you so. And in a way, that was just the way the technology, that was just where the technology was going. So there aren't surprises.
We told you so. Sir Nigel Shadbolt er ikke overrasket overhovedet. Men som man siger, bare fordi teknologien er der, betyder det jo ikke, at folk skal have lov at udnytte den uden regulering overhovedet. Hvis vi bare giver op og siger, det er slut med privatlivet, sænker vi samtidig barrieren for, hvornår domstolene vil give lov til folk bliver aflyttet. Og så bliver det jo selvforstærkende, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Han tager udgangspunkt i det engelske retssystem, som forstår privatliv ud fra en såkaldt rimelig forventning om, at man kan have tingene for sig selv. Men hvis alle har givet op, bliver det jo pludselig sværere at argumentere for, at ens krav om privatliv er en rimelig forventning. Det er op til os at blive ved med at argumentere for privatlivets fred, siger Sir Nigel Shadbolt. Kun på den måde kan vi fastholde retten til at gøre noget ved dem, der overvåger os uretmæssigt. Nemlig smid dem i fængsel, siger han og slår i bordet.
Privacy is a fundamental human right. It's there to guarantee us an ability to be autonomous, independent thinkers, to convene privately, to undertake conversations privately. Fundamental right. And just because technology exists to be precisely track us, or to see what we're doing online, or to extract patterns from our behavior. Just because that data is there, the technology is there, doesn't mean people should be allowed to do it completely without regulation. And it doesn't mean that if people do it, I can't hold them accountable in certain situations. So if I declare some of my behavior to be private, and it's understood that's a reasonable thing to expect, then we need companies and governments to respect that. In English law, which is a case law system, privacy is described as a reasonable expectation to privacy. That means when it comes to testing what your reasonable expectation is, the courts decide that's reasonable, that isn't. And if you have unreasonably broken my privacy, you will be held accountable, you will be prosecuted. If we all collectively give up on privacy and let the barriers drop, your reasonable expectations become lower. So it's down to us to keep arguing the case for privacy. Even in an age of the spy in the coffee machine, we can hold those spies accountable. We can rule them out of order, and ultimately we can put them in jail.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Man kan læse mere om Sir Nigel Chadbolls arbejde hos The Open Data Institute på theodi.org. Det staves theodi.org.
National Security Agency conducts worldwide surveillance. Fax, phones, satellite communication. The only ones in the country, including the military, could possibly have anything like this.
Why are they after me?
I don't know, and I don't want to know. Here they come.
Hej, jeg hedder Jacob Wolfhagel. Jeg har lavet julekrypto her i år.
Det hedder julekrypto. Hvorfor gør det det?
Det hedder det, fordi at det sådan udspringer fra kryptoparty, men det er ikke helt som sådan et kryptoparty, fordi der er ikke så meget hands on. Det er, vi holder tre foredrag om om forskellige ting, så tænkte vi, jeg vil lave noget her i julen, så kunne det være sjovt at lave et julekrypto.
Det første der foredrag, der har været, det har du selv stået for, det handler om whistleblower. Ikke fordi jeg tror, du skal sidde og gentage det hele her, fordi det var en meget lang og meget fornem gennemgang af alt, hvor Edward Snowden ligesom har afsløret her igennem det her år, der er gået. Men sådan ganske kort, hvad synes du, hvad har vi lært af det her år, der er gået?
Jeg vil sige, at vi har lært, at NSA stikker deres snabel i, kort sagt, alt trafik, de overhovedet kan komme i nærheden af. Mobiltrafik, internettrafik, alt trafik. Og opsnapper det igennem deres samarbejdspartnere rundt omkring.
Tænker du nu sådan, hvad tror du, de skal bruge det til?
Jamen, det undrer også mig lidt, hvad de skal bruge alle dataene til. Men altså, det er jo for at kortlægge, hvordan folk... hvilke sociale relationer folk har til hinanden, og hvem der er potentielle mål, og hvem der ikke er mål. Så derfor indsamler de data om os alle.
Masse overvågning,
ja.
Nu hedder det jo kryptoparty, og det, der man også plejer at beskæftige sig med, og det kommer vi måske også til senere, det er jo også, hvordan man ligesom skal for eksempel sikre sig imod, om ikke imod NSA, fordi det er ganske vanskeligt, men i hvert fald mod sådan almindelige sikkerhedsting. Kan du komme med sådan nogle, hvad er de gode råd, man skal huske at gøre, hvis man skal passe lidt på sig selv på nettet?
Jamen, det er jo for så vidt muligt at kryptere sin internetadfærd, og derudover så nok at holde sig væk fra de store dataudbydere som Google og Facebook og Yahoo og Twitter i så vid udstrækning, som man kan. Men altså, hvis man vil helt væk fra det, bliver man jo nødt til at smide sin mobiltelefon væk og aldrig bruge internet, og det er jo heller ikke realistisk. Så man skal selvfølgelig være klar over, at man bliver overvåget, og hvilke konsekvenser det har.
Så man skal tænke sig lidt om, hvad man skriver, uanset hvad?
Nej, jeg synes ikke, man skal tænke sig om, hvad man skriver, men man skal være, man skal have en idé om, hvad konsekvensen er af, når man offentliggør noget på internet, og hvem der opsnapper det, hvem der beholder det, og hvem der eventuelt vil bruge det senere.
De her afsløringer, det her år, der har været med alle de her afsløringer for Edward Snowden, hvordan har det påvirket dig?
Jamen, de har påvirket mig personligt, at jeg holder mig mere væk fra social interaktion på internet, end jeg har gjort før, og læser mange flere kritiske artikler omkring overvågning, end jeg gjorde før, hvilket vil sige, at jeg læser nærmest ikke andet. Og derudover, så ja... Jamen, så er jeg bare usikker på, hvad fremtiden bringer, fordi at NSA's overvågning er så massiv, og deres villighed til at invadere folks privatliv er enorm.
Hvis der nu er sådan, at der sidder nogen derude og siger, det er meget godt, de holder kryptoparty over i København hele tiden, hvad skal de så gøre, hvis de også gerne vil med på noget af det her?
Jamen, de kan jo eventuelt... de kan jo, man kan selv sætte et kryptoparty op der og finde nogle emner, man synes er interessant at tale om. Og så, hvis man ikke selv kan synes, at man har evnerne til at tale om det, kan man jo efterlyse folk til at tale om det på forskellige mailinglister, prosa. Man kan gå på Twitter og efterlyse teknisk begavede mennesker og aktivister osv., til at komme og holde foredrag. I dag har vi for eksempel en video, et video-link fra Aarhus, fra Prosas lokaler i Aarhus, direkte hertil, sådan, så der også sidder 10 mennesker derovre og lytter med på, hvad vi taler om i aften.
Har I gjort noget særligt for at sikre forbindelsen til Aarhus?
Jeg ved ikke præcis, hvad der er gjort for at sikre forbindelsen til Aarhus, men igen, det er jo ikke som sådan, kan man ikke beskytte sig mod al overvågning, men man skal nok regne med, at den finder sted, og hvis NSA har lyst til at gennemse en udsendelse med, hvad vi har lavet i aften, så skal de være velkomne. Men de skal også vide, at vi holder øje med dem, og hvad de laver.
Mange tak skal du have.
Fedt tak.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Og nu skal vi se på noget kunst, nemlig fra den japanske designer Hiroto Ikusei, som har brugt 3 måneder på at bygge sin egen hemmelige base.
I can't speak English very little.
Okay, what can you speak? Can you speak German?
No. Japanese, no.
No. But it doesn't matter if it's perfect. Just so we can understand. This is your computer?
Yes, my computer.
What can it do?
My memory is protect and block. Hacking or virus CIA. My memory in my computer broke. Protect, defense.
Oh, and that's why all the weapons are to protect it.
Yes. Japanese toy, Pramodel.
And what does the camera here? It films us.
This is decoration. Web camera is there. Web camera.
It's on top of a gun. So it's also, and the camera is also protected by a gun.
Yes. And this is mouse. This is mouse. Yeah. USB flash memory. Speaker.
And it protects from spying, or what is the protection needed for? Do you protect against spies? Against an NSA or something like that? Is it a protection against who has all these weapons? Who are they protecting you from?
From my memory, Japan. Sorry.
It's very beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Hiroto Ikuishis hemmelige base er, hvis ret skal være ret, en ældre stationær PC, som han har splittet ad i enkeltdele. Og så har han gået i gang med det helt store modelbyggeri med plastik og lim og det hele. Musen er skabt om til en tank, og oven på skærmen retter der, hvad der ligner, tyske soldater rundt og svejser og bygger om. På toppen står et DSLR-kamera, nu lavet om til laserkanon. Bagved flankeres det hele af en affyringsrampe for en rumfærge, så han kan komme væk siger han. Der er også en lille højtaler, formet som motoren i en raket. Og den kan faktisk sige noget. Computeren virker. Vi har lidt tid nu til en lille historie fra i dag. Den her gang der er det fra Ars Electronica i Lens tidligere på året. Midt i den her konference, der handler om kunst og fremtid og genetik og den slags ting, der var der en række lysende stander og et stort kort, hvor man kunne se forbindelser mellem Østrig og Sydamerika. Og så var der nogle skærme med hvad jeg vil kalde elektrisk aktivitet. Sådan nogle små bølger, der ved nærmere eftersyn viser at stamme fra enkelte løsrevne hjerneceller, der kunstigt blev holdt i live i Petriskåle og bagefter blev forbundet med hinanden via internettet. Mød Big Brain.
What is the Big Brain project?
The Big Brain project consists in growing neural cells in different parts of the world and connect them interconnect them through internet. This is the basic idea of the project. But the concept of the project is we ask a question, start with a question saying that are we individuals or are we part of the big ecosystem interconnected with a common object? What we do, we don't know exactly what is what we, and with this question we start working the project and making, trying to connect these cells, making a kind of hybrid, a combination between biological matter and technology, and we compare the synapses that the traditional networks, neural networks, make with the kind of digital synapses that is made in the different connections around the world.
Er vi egentlig individuelle og ægte individer? Eller er vi snarere en slags offer for hinanden? Enkelte ensomme celler, der påvirkes af verden udefra? Det er det spørgsmål, som projekt Big Brain stiller. Big Brain, den store hjerne, består af en række enkelte hjerneceller, som ligger i en petriskåle, der igen står på forskellige universiteter i verden.
So these neurons, they are in petri dishes somewhere in Buenos Aires and somewhere here in Linz?
Yes. Basically, in Buenos Aires there is a bio-art lab at Maimonides University, where we are working in three different lines of research lines regarding this kind of cells, or cells that could be used as a media for art. And for, I'm not a molecular biologist, but here is the doctor that is in charge of the scientific part of the project. And I know we are working with, for example, the tentacles of snails. They are very, very, they have a lot of nerves there, and we can use them as to collect light, for example, and sound, and transform these signals into electricity. Also, the second way is to, we are working with neural cells that are being grown into polymer scaffolds, to trying to make nerves that will react with electricity and modify the shape. And the third type is working with some cells from that react with the light, like from the eyes, and they can be there are cells that can be combined with genes that can react with the light, so we can make a kind of a tissue that will work as an eye, or what we call a bio-opto-electronics device.
Man kan altså se udslagene fra de her stimulerede celler på store skærme, der viser fluktuerende, blafrende grafer. Cellerne er levende. De er levende, men de er ikke fra mennesker, for så starter man jo en lang etisk debat, og det er jo et sundhedsskadeligt, så de bruger rottehjerner, men rottehjerner reagerer fuldkommen på samme måde som mennesker. Big Brain Project er opfundet af argentineren Joaquin Fargas, og ideen der er at skabe en hjerne, der spænder om hele verden. Ved at sætte cellerne sammen over internettet, så kommer det til at virke som synapser, mener altså folkene bag.
Well, the cells that you are, we can actually kind of touch from here or do something with, they're not human.
No, they are not human. We are not working with human. They are from rats or different species that are we have no problem to work with them. Working with human cells, that the doctor says, is there are some biohazards that has to be taken into account. It's not just a matter of bioethics or something like that. It's about health that we have to. This is a project that has to be keeping under control.
No. So you can't just do a Frankenstein and take some brain cells out of someone and put them in a box and start to play with them.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe in the future, everything is possible.
Okay.
Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Aflyttet fra Kryptoparty hos Prosa er forbi for i dag. Skulle du sidde derude i hovedlandet Jylland og føle dig groft forbigået, så er der håb. Der er nemlig blandt andet Kryptoparty i Jylland den 18. februar på Aarhus Hovedbibliotek. Vi vender naturligvis tilbage igen i næste uge med mere nyt fra overvågningssamfundet. Det er stadig galaksen mange af os bor i, og vi bliver stadig flere. Jeg bliver mere og mere tæt herinde. Temperaturen stiger, døre bliver smækket i, raketter tændes, og nogen, de særligt rige nok, stiger til himmels og finder et nyt sted i universet. Et sted, hvor de kan drømme om sandheden i en sjæl og i et legeme, men det bliver ikke lige nu. Og de ved det, men måske om lidt. Call connected to the NSA. Complete transmission to the NSA. Suspending your rights for the duration of the permanent war.
Til Radio 24/7's programmer, når du vil. Find hele vores streamingarkiv på radio247.dk.
Det Røde Felt er et program, hvor jeg hver mandag hisser mig op over den politiske udvikling og forsøger at provokere mine gæster til også at engagere sig lidenskabeligt i den politiske dagsorden.
Har du lyst til at følge med i den politiske debat i Danmarks eneste venstreorienterede debatprogram? Så stil ind på Radio 24/7 hver mandag imellem 10 og 12.
Det er en mærkelig ting at være flagellant og pisse sig selv, men det er nogle gange bare den skæbne mange på venstrefløjen har.
Her sender vi Det Røde Felt, hvor Lars Trier Mogensen rusker op i venstrefløjen.
Fair nok, og hurra for det.
Ja, ja, men du siger jo tingene, som de er.
Men lad os lige stoppe der.
Hør Lars Trier Mogensen, når han tager fat i de positive sider af venstrefløjen.
Hvis du kigger tilbage på det forløb, der har været, hvad synes du så, der har været det allerstørste nederlag?
Lars, vær nu flink.
Prøv lige at spole tilbage og forklare mig det skift, der er sket.
En ting er sikkert. Lars Trier Mogensen kommer op i det røde felt.
Når I taber valget, og vi får 10 års borgerlig regering med, så når I kommer tilbage om 12 år, så er I klar med nogle nye gode valgløfter.
Hver mandag fra 10 til 12.
Jeg må anerkende, jeg synes, du gør det. Altså, med en vis elegance og en vilje til så at stå lige her igennem.
Her på Radio 24/7.
Men så er jeg ude af det her. Her går min grænse. Nu bliver jeg nødt til at stoppe. The box stops her. Den her debat skyldes nogle klynkehoveder, som på den ene side ikke, når det kommer.
Radio 24/7. Download vores app til Android eller Apple og få taleradio med overalt.
Hver tirsdag 10.05.
Men siger du dermed, det du sagde før, med, hvis ikke man er i regeringen eller på bænken, vil det sige, at det er kedeligt at være i opposition?
Dødssygt.
Huxi hanker op i folkestyret og giver det et kærligt ord med på vejen.
Men kan I ikke give dem et godt råd så, hvis vi skal starte der?
Sammen med et panel af pensionerede politikere.
For eksempel, hvis du skal give Henrik Sass et godt råd i dag.
Det tror jeg er håbløst. Det må jeg sige. Der sætter jeg grænsen.
Det må du ikke sige.
De kender borgen indefra.
Der bliver sat så meget overstyr. Det er helt vildt.
Hør Huxi.
Og det gode gamle Folketing.
Tal rent ud af posen.
I kan se, at Folketinget antallet stiger. De er spindoffe. De er alt sådan noget. De stiger og stiger og stiger. Der er kun én ting. Det begynder helt forfra. Fy hele bunden.
Hver tirsdag 10.05 på Radio 24/7.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Om lidt er der nyheder.